And another Sunday rolls on by. Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, information you'll need to view the solar eclipse coming up tomorrow and how a local nonprofit feeding the homeless hopes to expand their services in Dayton. Up first, this summer, we're bringing you stories of Ohioans living with disabilities. Today, we explore the issue of employment discrimination and access. And WISO producer Anna Lurie introduces us to Susan Kohler and Tom Webb, who both have cerebral palsy. They say work environments often aren't set up to accommodate disabilities. Many people with mobility issues in the workplace need special software or other assistive technology.
Assistive technology has been a big deal for me because I cannot type, but I can use my voice. So I need an employer who is willing to set up that software and allow me to use it. And a big one for me is having someone to come in throughout the day and help me with certain daily living tasks. What accommodations do you need in order to work your job successfully? And how has your disability impacted your work environment?
One of the things that I use on a daily basis is a mobility scooter. And that was something that I didn't start using until I was in my late 20s. I was actually working on Capitol Hill as a Kennedy Fellow at the time, and every meeting that I was trying to get to around Capitol Hill, I was 15, 20 minutes late and I had lost about 30 pounds in a matter of a month. So it was finally suggested to me by my boss, you know, you might want to look at a mobility scooter. And that's really changed my life in terms of the workplace and having enough energy to get through the day.
How do you deal with misconceptions in the workplace? For example, I had an employer who had a bad situation with a person with a disability. And right in the interview, he sort of told me about that. So I knew from the beginning that I had to work extra hard to prove a stereotype almost wrong.
Yeah, for me, I think the challenge has been employers making assumptions that I can't do something. Perfect example is, you know, I went out for a dispatcher job when I was in college. I did the interview. I completed the test for proficiency in typing and everything. And then later I found out, about a week later, that I didn't get the job. And the word on the kind of the gossip in the office was the reason I didn't get it was because it was down five steps into a sub-basement. Well, I can do steps. It just takes me a little bit longer.
Yeah.
And it really wasn't a huge deal. But I think that employer made the leap and made the assumption that I couldn't do steps or that there was a safety risk involved there. There's many times where I have come into contact with colleagues or bosses that have either regarded me as being extremely brilliant, like Stephen Hawking, and expecting me to know the next great theory of something, or the far end of the other end of the spectrum is that I have an intellectual disability and I can't do anything. And I think those are those assumptions that sometimes really get in the way of us trying to get jobs and get work done.
Yes, I would agree. People either think I'm like smarter than I am because I've overcome so much. They think I can do anything. And I'm like, no, I'm pretty much like the rest of you guys. What do you hope would help other people who are going to be facing the issues that we've all faced?
It's a real challenge, no matter what your level of disability, to find meaningful and gainful employment. It's a kind of a bleak picture, I would say, for most of the disability community. I think that if we're in a work environment that is truly inclusive, and if it's universally designed, that any type of ability level should be able to work in that environment. And there shouldn't be a need for a ton of assisted technology. It should just be built into the operation, the furniture, the equipment that you're using. We're not there yet. We have laws that dictate that, but it's still not a common practice. And I say that's really ultimately my hope, though, is that it just becomes more part of our culture moving forward.
You've been listening to a conversation between Tom Webb and Susan Kohler, participants in our series Just Ask, talking about disability. Susan works from home for a public relations company. Tom is the director of Wright State's Office of Disability Services. To learn more about our series, visit us at WISO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. On Monday, August 21st, all North America will experience a solar eclipse. It promises to be an awe-inspiring event for viewers, especially those located under the path of totality. And to get more details on it, we spoke with Linda Weiss, president of the Miami Valley Astronomical Society, and Kevin Bassaro, president of Oberwerk in Dayton. Oberwerk is a high-performance optics studio for Earth and Sky. First, Linda has some background on the Astronomical Society.
We're heading into our 100th year. That'll be next year. We began in 1918 as the Dayton Astronomical Society. One of our founding members was Colonel Edward Deeds. Right now, we've got about 178 members. We meet at the Boonshoft the second Friday of every month, 7:30. That's our meeting location. Our dark sky site is out at John Bryant State Park. There's an observatory out there that we lease. And that's where we meet.
I don't think a lot of people know about the observatory.
That's right, they don't. It's hidden way back in the park. Most of our events, though, we hold at the park. We hold down in one of the parking lots. We do an event between March and October, one a month. Our members come out with their binoculars and their telescopes to set up, and it's open to the public to come view the night sky.
So you've been functioning for a long time, and when I walked in here, you said things have been crazy because of people wanting information about the eclipse coming up?
Well, information, but also safe viewing glasses and filters for their binoculars, which we do sell here at Oberwerk. So we've been very busy.
And so, Kevin, let's talk a little bit about the eclipse and the path, which is kind of cuts a diagonal across the United States. Here in the Miami Valley, we're only going to see a partial eclipse, correct?
That's correct. We're going to be about 89% eclipse. So to be in the path of totality, we'd have to drive about 5 hours to the south. And that's actually what we're going to do.
Tell us what we need to know here in the Dayton area as far as viewing it safely. And again, more detail on how much we'll see or what we'll see and how we'll notice it.
Well, if you're not in the path of totality, there will be no point where it will be safe to look at the sun without the eclipse glasses or special filters if you're using a binocular or telescope. If you're in the path of totality, there's a period of about 2 minutes, two and a half minutes, where you can actually take off your eclipse glasses and look directly at the sun's corona because the sun will be totally obscured by the moon. But that's not going to happen in Dayton.
All right, so tell me what we need to view it here and how best to do that safely.
Well, the club has been distributing the eclipse glasses. I believe they're pretty much gone now. We've probably distributed about 1,000 of them. But if you don't have them, I don't think you're going to find them. And that's what you need to look safely at the sun. There's other things you can do. You can make a pinhole, take a piece of paper, put a pinhole in it, and have the sun project through that to another piece of paper, and you'll see a image of the sun on that. So
viewing this safely or not looking at it directly, is that anything that you can state too much?
No, because it doesn't take long at all to cause permanent damage to your eye. So
looking through a telescope is just as dangerous as naked eye. Is that correct?
More so if you don't have the filters, because that's concentrated light. So you could damage your eyes in less than a second with a large binocular or a telescope. So it's important to have proper filters to use those devices.
Specifically, this will take place on August 21st. What times are we looking at?
It'll start at 1:02 in the afternoon, and the maximum here in Dayton will be at 2:28, and it'll end at 3:51. So it's a long period, about 2 hours and 49 minutes.
So you mentioned the fact that you're traveling, and do you know a lot of people from the Miami Valley that are heading down to see this?
Oh, yes. Most of our club members are leaving town. Some have already left. Others will be leaving this weekend.
And the significance is that this has happened when last time? 100 years ago?
About 100 years ago, since we had totality in the U.S. But we do have totality coming again in 7 years. And next time it's coming right through Dayton.
So, oh, very nice.
Yeah, April of what year is that?
April 8th of 2024. It will come through Dayton.
Well, great. We'll look forward to that one, and perhaps we'll speak again. Anything else we should know about this particular event?
Get out and enjoy it. Don't worry about photographing it, because there again, unless you have filters for your cameras, you really can't do it safely, but get your safety glasses, make your paper pinhole boxes, whatever it is, but get out and enjoy it. Experience it.
Linda, let's end with contact information for the Miami Valley Astronomical Society for anyone who might want to get involved.
You can go to our Facebook page, Miami Valley Astronomical Society. You can go to our website, mvas.org. Those are the two best places to contact us.
Linda and Kevin, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Linda Weiss, president of the Miami Valley Astronomical Society, and Kevin Bassaro, president of Oberwerk in Dayton. Safe viewing to all our listeners on Monday. This is WISO Weekend. The nonprofit House of Bread in Dayton was founded more than 30 years ago with the belief that no one deserves to go hungry, and today they are serving more meals than ever to families and people in need in this area. They just kicked off a major capital campaign to expand their existing facility in West Dayton. To talk more about their needs and goals to continue serving Miami Valley residents, here's Executive Director Melody Bennett of the House of Bread.
At the House of Bread, our mission is to basically prevent hunger. So we do that by serving a hot, nutritious lunchtime meal every single day of the year to anyone who walks through our doors. And we do that by creating an intentional atmosphere where we treat our guests with respect and with dignity and where people feel valued here. When someone is in the situation of living in poverty, as all of our guests are who come to us, they often are treated as such. You know, our guests don't always have the nicest clothes on. They don't always, you know, have a fresh shower every day and access to everything that they would like. Many of our guests are in homeless situations. Many of our guests are dealing with, you know, simply the trauma of trying to get by day to day.
You not only do the daily program services, but additional services during holidays. Do you distribute gift bags and needed supplies to people?
Absolutely. We have what we call Hygiene Tuesday, which is our distribution of hygiene items to our guests on Tuesdays. Hygiene items are really, really hard to come by in communities like ours. And neighborhoods like ours, it sounds a little odd, but items like basic hygiene, you're going to pay much more on Salem Avenue than you're going to pay on Stroop Avenue. And so we do that on holidays when we're open. We try to deliver an experience to our guest that is similar for that holiday if they were not in their situation that they're in. So, for instance, on 4th of July, we have a picnic outside. We offer, I think this year we did conies, you know, hot dogs with the chili sauce and the cheese and all that and all the fixings. On Thanksgiving, we do a traditional turkey with, you know, gravy and dressing and what have you. And then on Christmas, we offer gifts to our guests, from our youngest guest to our oldest guest.
Did you mention how many people you serve every day or annually?
We prepare and serve, last year, it was over 123,000 meals. So we average every day anywhere from about 210 to about 250 guests. We also prepare food for other programs that are serving people at risk in this community and you know, specifically in the couple zip codes around us. So that all adds up to about 123,000. We easily have well over 200 people in our dining room every single day.
That's quite an undertaking. And so how do you complete that? What's the structure like here at House of Bread as far as employees and volunteers who assist with this?
Okay. Well, we have a ratio of a tiny staff and a large number of volunteers every single day. We are really, really fortunate to recruit on average about 12 volunteers every single day that come in and do everything from bring in donations of food to put away and sort to, you know, literally dicing the potatoes and cooking the chicken to putting that food on a plate and offering it directly to one of our guests, to helping us mop the floors, to helping us do the dishes. And then we typically, on an average day, we're lucky if we have four staff people here.
So I know the daily operations are a struggle, but you have an added capital campaign underway, and let's talk about that size and significance.
One of the things that we've seen, Jerry, over the last couple years is a significant increase in the number of families that are coming to us. And that's for a lot of different reasons. We not only see single moms coming to us, but one thing that surprises many people is we have single dads that come to us. And while we'll occasionally get both mom and dad, many of our guests are employed, at least part-time. And so they're often not together with their children at the same time. One of the things we also see is an increase in the number of grandparents that are raising their grandchildren, not by choice, and in the number of what you would call kinship, like aunts and uncles stepping in. You can attribute that to a lot of reasons, but we're definitely feeling the effects of that. And so one of the things that has become clear to us over about the last 2 years is having families in our dining room that, by the way, seats about 135 people at a time. And remember that number of over 200 people every lunch. Along with our guests who are single, who are possibly dealing not only with a homeless situation, but possibly with addiction issues, most likely with mental health issues or physical health issues. The two populations don't always blend very well in our dining room. They have very different needs. And so we started this capital campaign with the idea of, we need a separate family dining room specifically for our families with children so we can address their needs directly. So that we can carry little Johnny and little Sally's tray to the table for them, so that they always have a table where they can eat together. And I don't have to ask my single guest, honestly, to move seats so that Sally and Joey can sit with Grandma. And that's really, really important to us because we want to treat all of our guests like they're of equal importance to us. And by creating a separate space for our families, we not only help our families, but we also help our single guests who are dealing with their very own unique issues.
And so you're in a somewhat small facility here. And so this is all about expansion and being able to expand those services and do them in the proper manner.
You know, absolutely. We like to say we do a lot with a little. You know, we don't have a huge budget here, obviously, with a tiny staff. It's not a fancy building. We like to create a warm and welcoming atmosphere. We paint the walls, we clean the floors, but it's not fancy. It's what you kind of expect a kitchen to look like. And we know we're located where we need to be, Jerry. We know this neighborhood and community needs us where we are. And so we want to expand here. We don't want to look at moving. We don't want to look at our guests trying to figure out where we are. We want to add on here so that we can, you know, literally serve closer to 200 people at the same time. So no one feels like they have to get up and vacate their seats if someone else can sit down. So we have the time to bring in resources specific for our guest. And if that means, you know, a case manager from another agency that they may need to meet with, if that means someone from the mental health community that they may need to meet with, we want to have that ability to, you know, I don't want to say expand our services because I don't want to give people the wrong idea, but we need to create space in order to improve our services. And we've been, you know, somewhat successful so far in going to the community, primarily local foundations, and saying, hey, this is who we serve. This is, you know, this is what we're doing. This is why. And we could really use your help in doing so. You know, it's an ambitious campaign. And I think there are people who could look at it and say, oh, you know, yeah, that's an inner West Dayton. Gee, it sounds kind of like a lot. But, you know, I don't think we see, you know, we see it that way. We've been operating out of this building since 2002, and we've done it very successfully. And we could continue to limp along, or we can take a bold step forward and say, you know what, we're going to make a bigger difference for our guest. And we're going to offer the opportunity for that family that drives by on a Saturday and they look through our windows and they see every seat taken and they say, wow, there's no room for us. You know, we need to come in, but we're not coming in. We want to create space for them where they feel welcome. We want anyone in this community or this neighborhood to feel like they can have a seat at our tables.
Well, let's end by telling people how they can get involved either in volunteer services or in this capital campaign underway.
Easiest thing to do, you can do a couple things. You can go to our website, which is houseofbread.org. There's a donate page that's actually going to bring you up an article about our campaign and where we are. And you can donate directly to our campaign, or you can, you know, you could donate directly to operating, to the daily operation. You'll also bring up a calendar under the Get Involved section that literally brings up a calendar, shows you the days we're looking for volunteers, and there's a simple form you fill out that says, yep, I'll come in and volunteer with you. And then we're going to send you a reminder a couple days ahead of time and ask you to confirm you'd like to come in. It's a 5-hour commitment, and it's honestly for some people, I'm a little biased here, but somewhat of a life-changing experience to realize that, you know, 20 or 30 minutes down the road are over 200 people who need lunch every day. And so you can also follow us on Facebook. We have a presence on Twitter. We tend to put a lot of stories out there trying to convey to people, you know, what it is that we're trying to accomplish and how you can help us.
Melody Bennett with House of Bread. Good luck on the Capitol campaign and future operations here.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. The United Nations estimates that world population will increase by 11 billion by the end of the century. UD professor Bob Brekka is thinking of how population and sustainability are related and brings us this commentary.
When I was born, world population was less than half what it is today. I think it's clear that one reason we've started talking about sustainability at all is that the large human population is placing a lot of stress on ecosystems and natural resources. But even today, it's really only about 1 billion people who are heavily consuming resources. Most of the world's population actually leaves a fairly small footprint on the Earth. In the end, it's not necessarily the number of people that matters, but the total impact as measured by population multiplied by how much each person consumes. The challenge we face is that most of us believe that it would be a good thing if we could somehow lift the world's poor out of poverty. But increasing affluence correlates strongly with more consumption of resources. And that will mean more stress on natural systems. So one of the greatest challenges we face is to reduce poverty while minimizing impacts. Not an easy task. But back to the issue of population. If decreasing poverty might already add to environmental pressures, projected increases in population will certainly just make it worse, right? Let's step back just a bit. In 2015, United Nations member countries agreed to work towards 17 sustainable development goals. These include reduction of poverty, improving health outcomes, decreasing child mortality, and improving educational access, particularly for women. It's long been known that empowerment of women, especially in terms of education access, is a strong predictor of decreases in birth rates in developing countries. But the UN population estimates of growth to 11 billion by 2100 is made by assuming a kind of business-as-usual future, in which currents continue. If the world actually acts on the Sustainable Development Goals by 2030, helping alleviate poverty and other ills for more than half the world's population, then more recent research predicts that the indirect effect will be to decrease the rate of population growth. This is all kind of complicated, but the real message is simple. There are far too many people in the world who live in poverty, far too many women who lack empowerment. Working with countries to alleviate poverty and enable human development in terms of education, health, and other measures is not only long overdue, but would help lead to world population peaking at 9 billion in a few decades instead of growing to 11 billion by the end of the century. We could still argue about whether that's too many people for our Earth system to handle without damage, but all else being equal, fewer people and fewer desperately poor people in the world is better than the alternative, for many reasons. For WYSO, this is Bob Brekka.
Bob Brekka is a professor of physics and renewable and clean energy at the University of Dayton. He is research director of UD's Hanley Sustainability Institute and tweets at Bob Brekka. For more stories and commentaries, visit our website, wyso.org.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of late summer, the transition week to the cricket and the katydid moon. I settled in to watch like I used to do when I went fishing. I used to sit for hours then, focused on my bobber and fingering the tension on my line. The bites or strikes of fishes were signs that I had understood something of the river's mystery and of its creatures. Now, it had been a disappointing year for finding butterflies, and I'd worried off and on about climate change and the disastrous Anthropocene. Throughout June and July, only cabbage whites and an occasional blue had visited the flowers. Now, I hoped to see one of the larger, brighter, and far less common butterflies of late summer. So I cast out my virtual line. The garden, maybe 100 feet long and 20 wide, was full of flowers, and it was like a fishing hole that held secrets. Unless I watched and waited, I would not discover what elusive inhabitants might take the pollen lure. After half an hour, just one cabbage white butterfly. Another half an hour, and another went by. And then I saw them, low, about 2 feet above the ground, fluttering erratically up and down the bright drifts of zinnias and the stalks of fragrant milkweed, rising, then diving, disappearing, then showing themselves to me. My butterfly bobber went down. My fears about the fate of the earth went down with it. What was there? Was it real? A monarch? And then two, even in these end times? I stood up and approached the garden to see better. Yes, it was. One monarch, then two. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fourth week of late summer. In the meantime, watch for monarchs while you can.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with The Book Nook.